Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel, Dr. Craig Evans, who is the John Bassanio Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins at Houston Baptist University, and also your title, Christian Thinkers Society, Jeremiah Johnston. Are you a thinker?
I try to be. I try to not let it be an oxymoron.
That's true. Christian thinkers
for some.
It's Christians who think and trying to get people who think to be Christian.
That's exactly right.
That's
we take the commandment seriously. Jesus said, love God with your heart, soul, and mind. So that's what we're about.
You're the founder and president,
I'm told.
You didn't step back when everybody was, when they were choosing a president, saying, I'll do that. Hey, you guys have worked together before on other projects, right? What have you written before?
Well, it's really exciting, and I'm delighted to be joining both of you gents. I met Professor Evans in 2006. At the time, I was your typical seminary student with all kinds of gaps and pitfalls in my knowledge of what I didn't know.
No, really? He was a sophomore, right?
Yeah, being from the Midwest, I mean, I couldn't have even pointed at Nova Scotia on a map, you know, typical American, doesn't know any of the Canadian provinces. But I had never heard anyone lecture, at least to that point in my seminary education, on the Dead Sea Scrolls, see the papyrus fragments, understand the documentary remains that we have from the Greco-Roman world that teach us so much about Bible context. And I just wanted to shake his hand. And it's a much longer, really beautiful story where Dr. Evans eventually became my doctor father, found this great program.
Did you have
Oxford
to kiss his ring? Was there a ring?
No, I just gave him a good Kansas City steak. So that's what it
there
took.
We go. Okay, that's all it took. Huh?
But we began a great friendship, mentorship. And he found this really wonderful program at Oxford where I could be residential working in the Bodleian, but he would remain my doctoral advisor as long as I had a UK advisor who happened to be Paul Foster.
Oh, great. University of Edinburgh.
Yeah, right. So anyways, just that began a great trajectory of doing both heavyweight academic books together, a lot of media together, debates, dialogues. Dr. Evans leads our fellows program, and he's head of strategic studies at Christian Thinkers Society. And then also having a passion for heavyweight popular books as well. You know, Christian books that actually have citations at the back and are not just fluff.
Now, you guys did a book on Islam a few years ago.
We did. Jesus and the Jihadis. Came out. Yeah, it's been about 4 or 5 years.
Was that your first kind of big project together?
I think it was, yeah. We had co-authored entries for some pretty heavy-duty reference works, Oxford University Press, Brill, Macmillan, and a few other things, on topics that aren't that important, like resurrection, Son of God, things like that.
Kingdom of God.
So we've done some essays. We've also edited in the Studies in Scripture and Early Judaism Christianity series. We co-edited a volume on how New Testament writers understood the Old Testament, and that's the same series. It's just in the Red Series, the book you're holding in your hand, David.
Yeah.
Scribes and Their Remains.
Yeah, Scribes and Their Remains in the Library of Second Temple Studies. T&T Clark is the publisher.
That's right.
And it's 2019, 2020?
It came out last year in 2019.
Okay, yeah. So what's the big... You guys edited, so it means you didn't write the whole thing, but you saw the project through from conception to publication. So what's the big picture idea of this book?
Well, there is a backdrop to the book. It's not my first that I've done in that area, but David, as I think you know, things have changed a lot since you and I were seminary students, and textual criticism was understood about, well, you weigh some variants, try to figure out how the original text read, and that sort of thing. Now there's a great deal of interest in the artifacts themselves, the papyri, the books.
They themselves are trajectories, aren't they?
Yeah,
they become
important artifacts. They are themselves like early commentaries. The scribes who copied scripture, made annotations. So there's a great deal of fascination in the actual material remains of scribal and book culture. And that's what our book is dealing with.
Now, when you read the New Testament, the scribes and the Pharisees are kind of the bad guys. Are the scribes the good guys here? What have you done with these guys?
I think they're very good guys because they tell us about the history of interpretation. They really give us a unique look into the text, that it's both a staple text, but there's a story that goes along with the manuscripts. And if I might add, just being honored to have 11 contributors, but we have two contributors who are papyrologists, and English was not their first language, Italian papyrologists. So I think it's a great credit to the Academy for the diversity that came together to put out what I think is a unique book, bringing bib studs together, Bible scholars and papyrologists, to talk about what we actually have in the textual remain.
So what period are we talking about? Are we talking from the writing of these texts to what? The 5th century, the 4th century, the beyond? What are we looking at?
Yeah, I'd say the first few centuries. Yeah. It's the New Testament period, but like Jeremiah's essay was on a text that's actually pre-Christian. He's looking at an Egyptian papyrus, a letter from a husband to his wife about when he'll get home from work.
So,
and the reason that's important is that letter talks about things that are of vital interest to early Christians.
This is not a text message or anything.
No, it could have been, but no.
So the title of the chapter, Hilarion's Letter to His Wife, Child Exposure and Early Christianity. So tell us, who is Hilarion, first of all? And child exposure?
Yeah, this is so important because the documentary, the document papyri continue to shed light for us as we study the Greco-Roman backgrounds of the New Testament. And I think a lot of modern Christians today have no idea how relevant Christianity is, not only today, but to the values that Western civilization has been built on. So here's a great point. To your point, Dr. Evans, about this letter. It's pre-Christian. It's a few years before the birth of Jesus. Papyrus Oxyrhynchus 744. And it's a beautiful love letter from Hilarion to his wife, Alice. And it's a great letter. He's working in Alexandria, she and Oxyrhynchus. She will give birth to their child before he returns from his working trip. And he says to her on line 10, Eon ein theleia ekbale. It's this beautiful love letter. And he says, if it's a boy, keep it. Literally, the transliteration, if it is female, throw it out. And here's the point, culturally speaking.
Wow.
None of us, if we were in the Greco-Roman world of that time, would have batted an eye. That would have just been business as usual. And so in chapter...
So to value the male child.
Absolutely.
But then if it's a female child, just expose it, send it out. What would that mean for a child?
So it would infanticide.
Would be killed.
Immediately killed. And lest we think it's all just the guys that were doing this, we have evidence that the females were just as supportive because there were economic reasons, there were philosophical reasons, there was a lot of superstition, but mainly it was an economic driver of family planning in that era. And so we see this. And then when we begin to project that on the larger New Testament world, where you have Jesus in Matthew 18 who says, let the children come to me. He's not speaking about young disciples. He's speaking literally about children. And we see this new ethic emerge in early Christianity based on Jesus's teaching and care for children, that then we see it, I think, to its fullest expression in the Didache, late second century, mid second century, saying you shall not kill an infant. You will not expose an infant, where it speaks explicitly to, I think, what's going on in the larger world.
So this practice, how widespread was it? I mean, we're talking about Egypt, right?
Yeah.
But was it broader than that? Was it That's Mediterranean
a great
question, world or North Africa? What?
Very broad. And in fact, I talked about this in my book, Unimaginable, What the World Would Be Like Without Christianity. You see, this had gone on kind of similar to the gladiator games for a very long time. You see people like Plato, Seneca, has this very cryptic quote in Latin that a child that is monstrous should be quickly and immediately killed. So if you have a child born with deformities, disabilities, we see it in the laws of the 12 tables. So for hundreds of years, this practice was commonplace. And I think it even sheds light even on what we see in the Old Testament. We see the boys this time who are being killed in the time of Moses. We see this, I think it sheds light on some of the stories we hear in the Gospels as well from King Herod and others. And so I think it's important that Christians understand that nascent Christianity was culturally relevant because...
But also there was a subtext that we're not going to let these kids be killed.
That's right.
Or in some cases, Dr. Evans, they might have been snatched up by somebody who wanted to exploit them.
Prostitutes.
Yeah, that's right. Sex traffickers, pimps. They would take these infants sometimes and exploit them later, their entire lives. If you can imagine the hell, you know, you're born, you're thrown out in a dump, and some pimp picks you up, and that's your life. I mean, it's hideous. And Christians said no.
So it's like a slavery, in a sense.
It's slavery. Sex slavery. Oh, absolutely. It's slavery.
Yeah. And Christianity just recoiled against that.
Yeah.
Right?
And Christians were accused of ugly things. You know, Christians would have their sacred meal, the Lord's Supper, and it's the body of Jesus, right? And so the pagans would go, oh, I see, that's what you're doing. You rescue those infants because you eat them. And so Christians were accused of cannibalism, and that continued on right on through the first and second.
I guess if you're just listening in and you don't really know what's going on, you think, okay, they're eating the body and blood of
Christ. These guys are cannibals. Yeah,
yeah. There are other charges too, like Athiyoi. You're atheist, right?
They were without the gods.
Don't believe in the gods. Don't go to the temples. They don't.
Christians were the worst possible thing
in
the minds of the pagans.
Yeah. So we have Didache, we have other early Christians kind of recoiling against this practice.
Right.
And was there a time when people stopped doing it, you think, because of the kind of the impetus of Christianity?
Absolutely. We see this... We see this, I think, in Julian the Apostate, who a few hundred years later says, look at these Galileans. They even take care of people they don't agree with. We need to be like them. And so we see this legacy of the Christian church that if the early Christians saw one who was marginalized, obviously infant exposure would fall into that. Someone who's starving. We see this in the medical practices of the day. Christians, there was no social justice movement in the Roman Empire. That's not to say that some were not charitable. But Christianity innovates, as it did in many different areas, social justice, charity, taking care of the poor, the marginalized, the hurting, women. We see this with the, you know, what was Christianity's culture, closest competitor was the cult of Mithra, male only. And we see that women are included even in leadership. Isn't that innovative in the early Christian movement? So we see that Christianity had its tentacles in all of these cultural areas, that it was utterly relevant to life. And I think that's one of the legacies of why Acts tells us in Acts 17, it's taking the world by storm, upside down.
I love that image where Jesus talks about the kingdom is like yeast that goes into the dough.
Right.
You know, before you know it, the yeast has sort of permeated the whole of the lump, right?
Exactly.
And that's what Christianity was all about. Now, Dr. Evans, your chapter is called The Longevity of Late Antique Autographs and First Copies, a Postscriptum. Now,
this is the heavyweight. I want to say this is the co-editor. This is the hinge the whole book literally swings on.
When I look at the length of that chapter, it looks like it could be a whole book in and of itself. So the longevity of these autographs, right, and these documents, they're made out of papyrus, so, well, their writing material primarily, but it's made out of reeds and such. It's organic material, so it's going to pass away eventually, right?
Well, in the right conditions, it lasts a long time. The reason we have papyri is because of that. We have papyri that are 3,000 years old. So obviously lasts a long time. But what I'm concerned with was how long did it last back in antiquity? How long were the books themselves in circulation, being read, studied, copied, and so forth? I had never given it much thought. I can tell you a story. I was in seminary, and we were talking about the autographs. That's the word that refers to the original writings that the apostles wrote. And I raised my hand and asked the professor so-and-so, how long do you think the autographs lasted? Oh, he says, that's a good question. I'd never thought about it before. And he thought for a minute. He said, I don't know, 10 years, 20 years, I suppose. And it struck me as a perfectly good answer. I thought of all these cheap paperbacks you buy at a, you know, at the airport. They fall apart. You read it twice. The pages fall out.
You pay $5.99 for it.
Right. Out. Yeah, like that. Well, that makes sense. Well, years later, I'm reading up, you know, we're all getting into this book culture that we were saying at the beginning of this podcast. And I read an article by a classicist who was getting into libraries in ancient Rome. Hmm. And he wanted to know, kind of, he fell into it by accident. He realized, wait a minute. He started reading up on the literature, and it was just commented in passing here and there that this scroll that was recovered had been in use for 150 years. Or this scroll, this one over here, this book roll had been in use for 120 years. This one had been in use for at least 200 years. Hmm. So he had a section in one of his studies, which he then went on and explored further, talking about book rolls, literature, how long they were in circulation. And he noticed, you know, the average is 150 to 200 years. Man, it was like a light bulb went on in my head. Hmm. Wait a minute. What's this 10 or 20 year thing I was told? So I started doing research on it. And sure enough, here's a church father, Tertullian of North Africa, writing in Latin at the end of the second century, writing around 190, and he's quarreling with heretics who have altered the text of Paul's letters. Mm. And they'd say, well, this is what Paul said. And he said, no, the original doesn't say that. So he says, if you don't believe me, you can go see the autographs yourselves. Mm. And then he starts citing specific texts in specific locations.
Does he use the term autograph? Or the original? Or
he does.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, in Latin.
Okay.
And he does. And so and in Latin, it's authenticus.
Authenticus.
And so I thought, man, this is, well, he refers to seven letters. And then in another place where he's arguing against a heretical movement, he refers to yet another letter. So he is claiming, Tertullian, writing around 190, that there could be as many as eight of Paul's 13 letters, eight autographs, still in existence. Hmm. And I thought, man, that's really amazing.
That'd be about 150, 140 years
yeah,
after.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. And so, 135, 140 years, give or take a few years, depending on how we date the autographs. So that's what got me interested. And then here's this other bishop, Peter, who is in Alexandria, and he refers to the autograph, and the word he uses writing in Greek is written by hand, idiocheron, of the Gospel of John. And he says, thanks to God's grace, it still exists. I thought, what's he talking about? And he was saying this, we think, in the year 306, which would make John's gospel just over 100 years, depending on where you date it.
Sure.
Could be 110 years old by that, or 210 years old by that point. 200 years old. And what's he talking about? Well, Emperor Decius, who in 303, beginning in February 303, began to target Christian churches and scriptures and destroying them. Mm-hmm. That's why 3 years later in his Easter homily, this bishop, who later, by the way, was murdered, refers to, it's just by God's grace
that
it still existed.
Still
because it was on display. Christians made apologetic use out of their old books, not only because they were considered venerable, sacred, but they had the original reading, which protected them against the Johnny-come-lately heresies. Mm. And they'd say, that's not what the original says. So that's what I pursue in this chapter, and I also suggest this is why, unlike other religious writings of this time, the New Testament text is so stable. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, Fred Wissey, he's a retired Coptologist at the McGill University, and I know Fred, and I've been exchanging email with him, and he's read drafts of my paper, and he's very encouraging.
Now, what is a Coptologist?
Yeah, Coptic is the Egyptian language, and it made a resurgence in the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries in Egypt, and it makes use not of hieroglyphics, which everybody knows about, written inside the, you know, the tombs and so on, but Coptic made use of the Greek language, the Greek alphabet, and a whole bunch of Greek loanwords.
A lot of Greek words there.
That's right. And so what we have now are texts that we recognize are really old. And Fred Wissi was interested in Coptic, these old texts, Nag Hammadi, that's a place in Egypt where these Gnostic writings were found. Well, he was really lucky. He was an expert in the secret book of John. There are four copies of it. Two of them are what we call the short recension. Two of them are long recension. You know what? They don't agree at all. We know it's the same work, but you can't begin to guess what the original text looked like.
Based upon those four.
On those four. And most Coptic texts, we have only one. We have a few examples of two, and it's the same thing. When you have two or more, you just, oh my goodness, who knows? Now, can you imagine if that were the case in New Testament textual criticism? If we had, all we have are two copies of Matthew, and they're miles apart.
Whoa,
we're lucky, we have four copies of John. Oh my gosh, two of them are short, two of them are long, and they don't even agree. So Fred Wissi was really sensitive on this question. So he was asked at a conference 30 years ago to comment on the text of the New Testament. And he says, I can't explain how the text is so stable. He said, I guess the scribe simply respected the text and didn't make any changes. So he was contradicting big shots like Helmut Kester at Harvard, who said, oh, yeah, yeah, the first 100 years the text is wildly changed.
Wildly crazy.
And he said,
corrupt.
And Wissi said, you'd think there'd be evidence for that in the early papyri, but there isn't any. So he said, the text is stable. So I thought, Wissi made an interesting observation. Why is that? And my conclusion is, at least in part, the autographs survived, and everybody copied them. People compared them, and we have ancient testimony to that effect. And by the way, the pagans did the same thing with their own writings. So this is nothing strange. And other studies show that Christian scribes, you might call the Christian book culture, was essentially the same as the general book culture of the time. And the idea that you'd take an autograph and make crazy changes, that's not true. It was the Gnostics and a few other outliers that did that kind of thing, not the Christians. And by the way, many of the early scribes that made copies of Christian writings, they were pagans, professional scribes. They had no theological dog in the fight. They had no motivation whatsoever to make changes.
They were being paid.
They were paid to be accurate.
To be accurate, yeah.
And the idea of, oh man, I need to redact this text and enhance the Christology. I mean, how would they know that? Yeah. How would anybody in the second century know what the Nicene Creed was going to read in the fourth century? It really is silly, this idea that the text was being tampered with, theological motives. Gosh, we've got to change the gospel so Jesus comes out right. This is really quite silly.
Yeah. And this book is, I'm looking forward to reading it. This is my first time to have it in my hand, but I'm looking forward to being kind of sinking my teeth into this. Thank you guys for being a part of our conversation today.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Thanks to Brent Johnson and Janet Seifert for editing these podcasts. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.